So, as was mentioned, I started my work in the U.S. Marine Corps as a nuclear biological chemical warfare defense instructor. And so that field deals with, in some ways, the misuse of modern technology by modern humanity to create weapons of death and destruction. But it really is an analysis of physics, biology, and chemistry. And so to really be able to work through these large fields, you need to be able to perceive patterns. So I did a lot of work in pattern recognition. And I found something really remarkable. When I was in the Marine Corps, I found a document that was paid for by NATO that was a study of biology, chemistry, natural systems based on pure geometry. Now, for what we have in a lot of modern science, the analysis would be in terms of complex algebraic equations. But the majority of the public has a kind of post-traumatic stress disorder from high school math and isn't going to deal with any of that. But when I saw that you could model all of these natural systems based on pure geometry and shape, that to me was a revelation that this is really the way that everyone can understand what's happening in our natural systems. And it also combines the scientific studies with spiritual studies. I then got my PhD in international studies, and that also gave me time to be able to study the knowledge of patterns that was developed by humanity for thousands of years before our modern materialistic era of scientific research. And of course, this understanding of patterns from classical spiritual and healing traditions is what we refer to today as sacred geometry. So I created the Vesica Institute for Holistic Studies, where at one time all of our classes were live, but now everything is online. And so we teach courses related to sacred geometry and spiritual science and Egyptian biogeometry, which I'll talk about a little bit later. And the goal of this is to be able to give people a clear, concise overview of some of these systems based on ancient knowledge that is being rediscovered today in a somewhat more materialistic form, but really is the key to everything. You don't have freedom of action until you understand the patterns that things are based on. You're a victim of the pattern until you understand it. At that point, you can start to work with it and navigate it. And so that's a big focus of our work. And I know that some of you have probably seen my recent series on the Gaia Channel. With the Sacred Geometry series on Gaia, I've done my best to introduce sacred geometry as an articulate language, as it was understood by the ancients. That all the forms, all the patterns in sacred geometry are like a letter of an alphabet. And higher nature creates all living beings and all worlds based on these specific patterns. And I was so excited to find the work of my esteemed colleague who's presenting today, because he's done an incredible job of being able to map out these multiple stages of DMT experience according to visual phenomena that is perceived. And I find that very exciting and a really major contribution to the field. So one of the first things that Andre talked about, which I really agree with, is that in many of our modern materialistic understandings of things like psychotropic experience, often it gets reduced to things like the architecture or the modes of functioning of the visual cortex. And it gets, there's an attempt to pretend to a level of knowledge we don't actually have, and to try to keep things in a completely materialistic box that really doesn't explain the observed data points that we have. But it's much more comfortable for people in many parts of academia and modern science who have staked their particular authority and income on sticking with the materialistic model. But if we're really going to get into what the significance of this is, I think we have to have some type of honoring of our ancestors who, for thousands of years, have used psychotropics for incredible levels of personal development and mind expansion, and understood it in a much larger, more holistic context that today we would call a spiritual context. And so I want to make a few comments about that, tying in to some of the things that Andres was talking about. So one of the first things he talked about was this modern idea that in physics, we now understand about wave-particle duality. But a lot of modern science is still caught in an 1800s model of a type of physical matter universe that actually doesn't exist. Modern physics knows that everything that appears solid to us is actually 99.99999% empty space. And then vibration modes of particles create the illusion of solidity. Now, it's a pretty real illusion when you're in a physical body and you get hit by a truck, but it doesn't change the fact that on an existential basis, modern physics has proven everything is creating an illusion of solidity through pure vibration. And they have the concept of everything in physical existence comes from the collapse of the wave function. And so it's actually these energy waves, information carrying waves that are also referred to as structural waves, that actually provide the foundation of everything that exists in the physical world. Now, in modern materialistic science, the way they try to get around this is when you look at something in nature that's organizing itself in an extremely precise geometric way, that's absolutely an incredible revelation of a higher intelligence. And you say, oh, well, how does it know how to do that? Then they just say, oh, it's self-organizing. And then they stop talking about it. Well, just giving it the name self-organizing doesn't explain anything. It's an empty placeholder of a concept. Same thing as if you ask, well, why do the birds fly south for the winter? And you say, oh, it's instinct. And that's the end of the conversation. Instinct is an empty placeholder of a concept. And so if we actually deal with the reality of a wave-based universe, and that these waves actually are what creates structure of all physical forms, and that these waves carry information, that's the state that we are able to move into through psychotropic use. And that's how humanity, our forebears, our ancestors, use this for thousands and thousands of years of recorded history. In our normal consciousness, in the way that Aldous Huxley described this in his seminal work on the doors of perception, he talked about his mescaline experiences and that he realized that what the human physical senses are a reducing valve. They reduce the flood of vibrational information of the wave universe that we live in into a very small system of parameters that allows us to operate consciously as a separate being, trying to figure everything out from our state of profound cosmic amnesia as we're wandering about, make sense of things through the reduction of information coming through the human senses. And so, following up on this idea, what's happening with the psychotropic experience is that we're opening up to direct perception of the wave-based universe. Now, that wave-based universe is always based, as Andres has mentioned, on mathematics and geometry. Geometry is the visual or structural appearance of the underlying mathematics. But again, for many people, it's much easier to work directly with the geometry of it, because any child can understand the geometry. So if we're dealing with this idea of a wave-based universe, we should be aware that the concept of waves creating the structure of everything that exists is something that keeps coming up in modern science and keeps getting hammered back down and rejected because it threatens the idea of modern materialism too much. So for example, the work of Alexander Gurvitch in Russia in the early 1900s, he demonstrated the way that there were these subtle radiations coming from living beings that affect all biological activity. Then that was taken up by Harold Saxton Burr at Yale University back in the 20s. And he identified that there were organizational fields of energy around living beings that actually construct the physical matter. And he referred to these as L fields or life fields. And Yale University did this work until he retired, he passed on. And then, of course, they got rid of all of it and pretended it never existed. Then Rupert Sheldrake in the 1980s with his work from Cambridge University on a new science of life has the same thing, morphogenetic fields, that these wave-based forms actually construct all matter. And so we keep seeing the reappearance of these concepts, even though they're not comfortable to a purely reductionist materialistic view of the world. And this is also related to some of the work that I do, and some of you may have even seen me speak about more recently, whether it's been in my Gaia series or in recent talks, that if you take a look at the information carrying capacity of waves and frequencies. There's entire fields now of microcurrent therapy in which we know that specific frequencies create specific biological activities in the human body. And this becomes a thing that gets generally suppressed for the public, because if you start talking about the information capacity of invisible waves, then you're going to get into the inevitable issue of electromagnetic fields and how the electromagnetic field frequency has biological effects, which they don't want to get into in modern science and industry because it opens them up to all kinds of lawsuits about, well, you're using this frequency, and they're afraid they'll freak everybody out. But it doesn't change the fact that we have a huge amount now of medical literature and information that specific frequencies of wave information is what actually creates every biological activity in the human body. There was a fantastic illustration in Andre's work where he was showing the Chladni plate. You change the vibration, the sound frequency that goes into the powder, and it forms into a different geometric mandala. Well, that's become the modern field of cymatics. And in cymatics, you can see a direct translation of invisible waves into structure. And so this then became the healing field of cymotherapy, where they knew how to create particular complex sound waves that create specific geometric forms, but more importantly, create specific biological functions in the human body and will resonate organs, glands, et cetera, on their specific resonant frequencies to bring them back to full activity. So this is a very practical thing. I'm trying to give a practical illustration of this idea that's so important about wave-particle duality. And what we're doing with psychotropics is we're perceiving that wave universe. Now, the problem for us, unfortunately, is that, again, all of this research in microcurrent therapy and about the information carrying capacity of frequencies, et cetera, has tended to be suppressed because of industry concerns about lawsuits for electromagnetic field frequencies. And so if we continue to work with this particular concept on the waves, then we get to the ancient understandings of what is the concept of vital life force or life energy in ancient traditions. Now, the problem is that modern biology has said that there is no such thing as vital life force. So what the Chinese call qi and the Japanese call ki and the Indians call prana and the Greeks call ether, we're not even allowed to discuss that in modern biology. When I had my first university course in biology, first thing I said on the first day is, biology is the study of life. And I thought, hey, I'm in the right place. And then the next thing I said, but there is no such thing as life. There's only a series of mechanical processes. And if you believe such a thing as life exists, you are a victim of the vitalist fallacy, and you will not graduate this course. And I thought, well, I'm in trouble then, because if you study any ancient tradition, their foundation of understanding all physical matter, all physical health, all states of consciousness have to do with energetic fields that structure and create all functions in the energy body. So we've proven today in modern science and medicine that these structural fields exist. We've proved that they have biological activities. And this was known for thousands of years in these ancient traditions. So to throw out thousands of years of observations in the Taoist tradition in China and the Hindu tradition in India, et cetera, is a huge modern mistake, because these people know a lot about psychotropic experience and about the possibilities within it. Now, we can also take a look here about how to unite the ancient knowledge of what we call today sacred geometry. It's the patterns of all existence. It's the cookbook of all the patterns that make everything in our world. This was taught to initiates in traditions all over the world in slightly different forms, but a lot of the same content. We need to unite that with modern observations in physics and mathematics. And once we can unite these fields together, classical, spiritual, esoteric healing knowledge with modern scientific observations, now we can become the technomage. Now we can become a new generation of holistic scientists that's going to have the capacity to completely change the planet and people's experience of life. And so, following up on this particular concept then, let's take a look at one of the very important discoveries that's been done by Andres and his research facilities, and that is this idea of hyperbolic geometries. So I'm just going to boil it down to its simplest possible parts. For those of you that have seen my Gaia TV series on sacred geometry, And there was an image from it that Andre showed. It shows you the torus and how important the torus energy field is. So let's pull together a few things that Andre's talked about in a classic sacred geometry format. At the highest level of spiritual experience in psychotropics, and now I'm talking about psychotropics writ large. This is including mescaline. This is including LSD. It's including all types of psychotropics and not simply DMT experience. But with all types of psychotropics, what happens at this highest level that changes people's lives, it changes their hearts, it changes their perception of themselves and the world, it takes away their fear of death, it does incredible transformative things for people, is the experience at the highest level of these trips in which we experience that we are part of the one, and there is one unified source to all of creation. And this is a healing thing for people because we all carry within us the imprint of remembering the state of oneness. And then we chase our whole lives that type of experience, sometimes through romantic relationships. We want to find that one person who's our perfect soulmate that we can unite and become one with. And that's where tantra and sex can become something of a spiritual experience based on the oneness, the reunification. That experience of the oneness, where everything comes from one unified source, and then everything separates out again, like cells of a body to have independent consciousness and activity, we become aware that's what we are. We're a part of the one. And that's, again, incredibly healing for us to experience. But we also have been given the gift to separate out from the one and have independent activity. It is the challenge every one of us has after a psychotropic experience of how do I integrate this incredible reunification experience into my independent life? How do I hold that in type of balance? So that direct experience of the oneness, the unity, is what's described from an external perspective in modern physics as the source of all creation is the singularity. What existed before the Big Bang? What existed before physical existence? Modern science says what existed was the singularity. It's the unified source of all creation. It's the one. In geometric terms, it's simply a point, a zero-dimensional point. And from that original center, that one unity state, the singularity, according to scientific theory and the Big Bang theory, that thing basically moved out from the point into creating physical space and time. And we need to be aware people misinterpret the Big Bang theory. They think that Big Bang theory means something blew up and filled up an already existing space and time. But modern physics isn't saying that. Modern physics is saying that there was no space or time until the expansion outward from the singularity, the one, the point, that expanded outward to become a sphere. And that became the container for manifest creation. Just as our bodies are made up of spheres of cells, just as all new biological life for human beings is based on the sphere of the egg in the mother's womb, all of these are microcosmic representations of the same geometric movement, just at multiple scales of creation. That's the way nature works. And so this idea of the singularity, the unity state that we experience internally in psychotropic experience and see externally in the singularity in physics, expanding outward to create the sphere of creation, that creates the archetypal symmetry state that was described by Andres as the foundation of having a good trip. The more symmetrical it is, the better the trip's going to be. If it gets unsymmetrical, it can lead to chaos, and you're just internally spinning head over heels and have no orientation and no direction. So this movement from the point to the periphery, the reason why the sphere is the perfect form of creation that everything else is based on, and people perceive so much of them in psychotropic experience, as well as seeing them everywhere in nature, is that the sphere is the perfect symmetrical form because every point on the periphery of the sphere is equidistant from the center. Now, classical spiritual traditions saw this in their own frame of reference, and they understood that that original point, the singularity, the state of oneness, is what they refer to as the divine plane. That movement outward to create the expanding sphere of creation that we talk about in physics today as our observable physical universe, that is the creation of the physical plane. And in between the two are all these other planes of consciousness and energy that then manifest. So that understanding of the original sphere the holder of creation, then moves in its next stage, as I describe in my Gaia series with illustrations, moves from the sphere, because that's a containing form, to become a dynamic energy circulation form for living beings. And the sphere does that through the process of hyperbolic geometry. And again, so I really want to give importance to what Andres is pointing to here. So what happens is that the bottom and the top of the sphere, the technical term is invaginate, but basically what it is, it creates a negative curvature. It moves inward, and that's then creating a hyperbolic movement. So the top and the bottom of the sphere begin to indent, and then they form a channel going through the center. Now that center point, the perfect point of establishment of harmony, of symmetry in the center of the sphere, is part of an energy circulation between the center and the periphery of manifest creation. And so we see this toroidal geometry in modern science being empirically rediscovered at every scale, from the subatomic all the way up to the galactic level. The human energy field is in the form of a torus. The human heart has fractal toroidal fields created around it. There was a fantastic book that appeared with the name Time Stands Still by Arthur Renfrey, talking about modern electromagnetic studies of the human heart in medicine, so that every time the heart beats, it creates a fractal cascade of a torus inside of a torus inside of a torus inside of a torus. The torus comes first. The physical heart forms around it. But every time the heart beats, it creates an electrical cascade outward of a torus inside of a torus inside of a torus. So everything in our structure is related to this. Same thing as the form of an apple is a torus. The form of a bar magnet creates a toroidal electromagnetic field. Now, the significance of this, because I want to tie a few things together here, but I had to give the foundation first, is that the importance of people at the higher levels of DMT experience, at higher levels of psychotropic opening to the wave universe of structural forces, of these hyperbolic geometries, is the hyperbolic geometries are based on the movement of the initial sphere from the point, the unity state, to the, what the Chinese call the 10,000 things, the multiplicity of the periphery of the sphere that creates everything. That this particular movement outward is based on the negative curvature, the hyperbolic movement that creates inside of the sphere something that looks like an hourglass shape. It's the widest at the top and the bottom of the sphere, and it's the narrowest at the center. It comes down to the absolute center, and then it comes back out again. So this is a pure grail cup. It's a pure hyperbola inside of the torus. Now, the torus, if we're seeing that people are seeing all of these geometries, hyperbolic geometries, in very advanced states of consciousness with psychotropic experience, we need to see what modern science is saying about what is the torus? What's some of the significance of the torus? Because, you know, if we say to a materialistic scientist, oh, I'm actually having a transdimensional perception in this, they'll say, oh, that's complete nonsense. It's just a bunch of artifacts of your visual cortex processing, and, you know, nothing else really exists. But if you go into the mathematical literature, you'll find books like Regular Polytopes by HMS Coxeter. Regular Polytopes by HMS Coxeter is a manual of higher dimensional geometries and their mathematics that are known to modern math. And in fact, for modern physics models to work out, they have to have at least 10 dimensions of space to be able to explain anything. But what they keep saying in these books, so if you take a look at Regular Polytopes by HMS Coxeter, you see these incredible hyperdimensional geometries that they've discovered and they know exist. But they keep saying something like in the forewords of these books, say, don't take this to mean that there's actually higher dimensions and that people are experiencing that in any way. This is all just a mathematical scientific thing. So don't think it actually affects your internal life or your experience in any way. This is a bunch of our abstract mathematics, but it keeps showing you that it actually exists. So as we're working with this, what we find is that this form of the torus with this dynamic circulation, like in the human body, it's from the crown center through the central channel of the body to the perineum, and it continues to circulate around. And in my Gaia TV show, as Andres was mentioning, I show what in the Chinese tradition would be called the heavenly flow, the earthly flow, and then what's rarely discussed is the mixed flow. Whenever two opposite energies move through each other, they will create an opening, a gate, for energy to come from some higher level. So if you take a look at what's said about the form of the torus in modern science, they say things absolutely fascinating about transdimensionality. And so what they say is that space-time itself is a matrix of energy. And anytime anything has mass in our physical universe, it actually indents or distorts space-time. Now, this is shown in physics books by, they usually illustrate it as a rubber sheet that's been pulled tight on all sides. And then they put a bowling ball in the middle, and the bowling ball then distorts the rubber sheet. What does it create? Negative curvature. What is that movement? That is the movement of the hyperbolic geometry that Andres was talking about. So everything that has physical mass in the observable universe is not the foundation of existence. It actually distorts the space-time matrix, according to modern physics, and it distorts it with hyperbolic geometry. Now, this is then the source of the black hole. Black holes, which cannot be clearly understood in modern physics today as to what happens in a black hole, they say, we can't know that. But the black hole is based on when that density, that mass, takes on so much intensity that it actually breaks through space-time and pulls things out of space-time. But then they go further and they say, well, but theoretically, that black hole could lead to something else. Maybe it leads to a white hole. And this then gives rise to the concept of the Einstein-Rosen bridge. The Einstein-Rosen bridge, you've probably seen in a whole bunch of science fiction shows. That's how the spaceships and science fiction shows can go from one point in space and time to another point in space and time instantaneously without traveling through, over time, the intervening space. Instantaneous connection between points. That's what we experience internally in psychotropic experience. Instantaneous connection between points in space and in time. We can experience other points in space in psychotropic experience. We experience other points in time without having to like watch our watch. How long is it taking me to get to that place in my psychotropic experience? You think about it and you're there instantaneously. That's our internal part of this. So if the Einstein-Rosen bridge, which is the transdimensional gateway to get from one point in space and time to another, is based on hyperbolic geometries, and we're perceiving these hyperbolic geometries in psychotropic experience, maybe that has some significance. Now, we could take this, I think, even a little bit further. And if you find in the deeper literature about this, there's a book called The Reflexive Universe by Arthur Young. And The Reflexive Universe by Arthur Young, he's a person that actually invented modern helicopters. He's talking about how important the torus is. And he says, if you mathematically analyze the torus, what you will find is that a sphere in three dimensions, if you move it to the fourth dimension, the sphere becomes a torus. The torus is actually a fourth dimensional hypersphere, according to modern mathematical and geometric analysis. Now, again, this is often presented in very dry mathematical terms. You're like, oh, okay, well, so what? But in your own direct experience with psychotropic experience, then you might experience that you're actually perceiving and experiencing this whole thing internally. And so this is a very, very important concept. Now, I'm almost out of my 25 minutes, so I just want to touch on something else leading into the discussions that we're about to have. And that is, what I find so fascinating in Andre's model here is that he talked about these multiple levels. I think he had six levels of different stages of psychotropic experience related to dosage level. And that you change what you perceive geometrically based on the level of intensity and depth of going into the experience. For that reason, when later on I'm being asked by the Psychedelic Society to give you a short energy meditation, the energy meditation we're going to do is the one about moving into the center of a center of a center in your own energy body. And so in understanding how these things are working dynamically and energetically, again, we understand that in ancient traditions, they talked about that we had at the highest level, the state of unity. That's our highest level of experience in psychotropic experience. And that's the state of amnesia. When you're fully in the one, you're just being, you just are. I am. But at that point, there's no separation to have our normal type of analytical consciousness about me versus that. For that, I have to be separate from it. Once I'm in it, that type of consciousness just fades away. And so when we come back and try to describe it, it's like either it's amnesia or there's no words for that state. So that's what they would call the divine plane. Then from that point, we go to what Andres was describing as bifurcation. And the bifurcation is related to the moving from the one to the two, just like in Chinese metaphysics, from the wu ji of the one to the yin yang. And at that point, by splitting the one into two, now we have separation from the other. Now energetic movement is possible because we have retraction and repulsion between opposite magnetic poles and opposite electrical poles. And we have the capacity then for movement and evolution that then makes everything else possible. So the movement into polarity, duality, yin-yang, masculine, feminine, all of these energetic aspects are what then create the manifest world. And when we're then working in the polarized world, that consciousness of the highest level of the one then becomes the consciousness of what classical traditions would consider to be higher spiritual beings, which they didn't consider to be abstractions. They considered to be actual conscious beings at a much higher level of scale than we are. And so it's fascinating to see that in Andre's work, he was talking about at the highest levels of the DMT experience, you don't perceive other beings as being like in human form. They're not anthropomorphic. Seeing other beings in anthropomorphic form is a lower state of consciousness. But if you have that higher state of consciousness, now they're like a pure information field. Now they're like a pure consciousness field. It's not being brought down to our level to clothe it like we are to try to understand it. It's like in a more pure experience of where they actually are. That's the spiritual plane that they talked about in ancient traditions. Next level is the causal plane. What's the causal plane from this perspective? Causal plane in the ancient traditions is where we are able to see the blueprints. It's what was called the ideal realm or the realm of ideas in the Greek tradition. It's the place that the sacred geometry templates are formed that then are going to give the shape to everything of the planes below it. Then it moves into what classic traditions would call the mental plane. That's where we can then form concepts with these geometric patterns in our own consciousness field. Then the emotional, where now we're forming the patterns in our emotional internal soul life. And then to the level of vital life force, chi, ki, prana, ether in the ancient traditions, which is actually what animates living matter and has a particular geometric form that then condenses from the wave at that level into the particle of the physical body. Now, that's the classical understanding of spiritual traditions all over the world. All of our forebears that suffered and struggled to then pass on to the next generation their knowledge, they suffered and struggled to pass this on to us. So I don't want to get that lost in our modern scientific discoveries, because I think if we bring all this together, the external view from the scientific, the internal view from the classical traditions and our own experience, then we have something very powerful.
I took a couple of notes. So I completely agree that, yeah, in the upper levels, the self-other divide collapses. And then, yeah, I mean, it's kind of the divine plane of oneness. From kind of like trying to make sense of this with kind of like scientific paradigms, like I think Feynman and Wheeler, you know, when they were looking at, okay, the quantum mechanics, what's called the Feynman diagrams, you know, how like subatomic particles interact with each other, they came up with this idea called the one electron universe, where if you look at the mathematics of some subatomic particles, sometimes, for example, an electron and anti-electron may essentially merge with each other and transform into a photon, kind of like pure energy. You can think of that as kind of like, you know, yeah, from how you're describing it, it's kind of like the one becoming polar opposites, you know, literally happens in physics. But there's also another crazy way of analyzing this, which is like mathematically, an anti-electron is actually the same as an electron, but moving backwards in time. So that particular movement actually could be interpreted as an electron bouncing off a photon and then starting moving backwards in time. And from this view, you can kind of reconstruct the idea that the whole universe, absolutely everything, can be created as just one electron bouncing backwards and forwards in time with itself in a pattern of self-interference. And yeah, kind of like the multiplicity on some level is kind of illusory because it's really just this one one point. I've also heard this concept called referred as the prime radiant, and like I'm sure there's like several ways of talking about it, but that's kind of the way I've heard about it, the idea of like the one point that generates everything. Then it's also kind of like conceptually it's going to be important to figure out how to like squares these with a concept of a field, because to kind of like elaborate on these in the TRI paradigms, the way you know we solve what's called the binding problem, which is like, okay, if you have like a lot of neurons in the brain, how is it possible they can simultaneously contribute to a unified experience? This makes no sense if your picture of the world is, you know, forces and atoms, right? It's like, well, at no point do you actually get like a holistic boundary arise in that kind of universe. Instead, the way we solve this at QRI is essentially realize that no, actually the universe is a gigantic field of consciousness. And the reason we are kind of like separate wholes in a way is that there is a topological bifurcation on that field. And I think a lot of like, for example, high dose psychedelics or sacred geometry meditation does is slowly but surely undoing these knots until you actually get a smooth geometry. And also, you know, for you to actually merge with the rest of the field around you, with the one, as it were, you need to already be in a fairly smooth geometry yourself, right? If you're kind of like, you know, heavily traumatized and stressed out and knotted, you will need to take care of that first, essentially undo your internal knots, your internal segmentations, before you can actually undo the bigger knot, which is a knot that separates you from the universal field of consciousness.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. So a couple of comments there. The whole idea that you presented there about our internal wormholes, I think, is of such profound significance for like where this work needs to go, because it's always possible when within a somewhat academic framework, because I come from academia as well, and then I went native and then I left, because once you go native, you're no longer considered to be a serious researcher. If you actually believe the things that classical traditions say about the psychotropic experience, rather than, oh, they're just having certain activations of the visual cortex, then that's not always accepted. But within academia, we can sometimes really be pulled into more and more mechanistic types of descriptions of this, and it becomes very external because we're taught to separate ourselves from the phenomena. It's like, oh, well, if you're actually a part of the phenomena, you can't be objective about it. Missing the fact that you can't ever understand the phenomena without being united with it. You know, we're creating a system of being divorced from reality, essentially, with all of this only external observation and not participant observation. So if we take this idea of internal wormholes that open up to become our direct access, like the Einstein-Rosen bridge inside of us, to connect to any point in space and time, that's what you find in classical spiritual traditions. So when you see it from that perspective, what they describe in the ancient Egyptian mysteries about the ability to connect different points in space and time in consciousness, which we think of as some kind of weird, you know, spiritual superstition thing. Well, no, they were actually working with something that's very deep and very profound, I believe. So let's see how the geometries relate to that. Not only is the whole human energy field with the form of the hyperbola from the crown center through the central channel of the body to the perineum, and then moving around us in the form of the hyperbolic geometry, but also every one of the major energy centers of the body that were identified by classical traditions like the Himalayan traditions are themselves part of a hyperbola, but it's almost never presented that way clearly in modern metaphysics. So I'll give you an example. In the classical work from India, there's an understanding that, let's say we talk about the heart chakra. The heart chakra is understood to be, a chakra means wheel. So it's a spinning form, it's a vortex. And they'll often talk about the vortex or represent the vortex. And sometimes I think about that just like a vortex coming in from the front at the heart chakra. That's the energy that's actually feeding that biological function. But in addition, in the classical traditions, they talk about, well, it's not just a front vortex or spinning field of energy moving into the body from the front. It's also in the back of the body. There's a rear heart chakra as well as a front heart chakra. And the two of them are actually connecting together, and the tips of the vortices are meeting at the central line of the center of the hyperbola moving through the body from the crown to the perineum. So the front and the back heart chakras are then almost touching in a spark gap in the very center of the body. And if we see that form, the vortex coming in wide at the outside, narrow in the center, that's the hyperbolic form that's in the center of the torus. So actually the front chakra and the back chakra are connected together in a toroidal field at that horizontal level of the body. And same thing for the solar plexus, same thing for the third eye center. These things are actually toroidal fields on a horizontal axis that are constantly circulating. And we have the Einstein-Rosen bridge. We have the fourth dimensional sphere. We have this transdimensional aspect where our consciousness can go any point in space and time if it's truly free, as shown in all the classical traditions. And so I think that's an important aspect of this wormholes in our energy field, that that's actually been mapped by the ancient traditions. So one of the things I so admire about what you're doing, Andres, is that, you know, you're really working on this mapping. And mapping, when you enter an unknown world, you know, when you explore in an unknown world, in this case, you're a psychonaut, you've got to map all these different places and where you go. And when you're mapping the cosmos that we're accessing through our consciousness, that's quite a big field. But we do have a big step up in the fact that if we really understand what's in the ancient traditions and what they're talking about, and we joined through geometry, because we can see the geometry they were talking about and match it to the geometries of modern science. And that's where I started my work at. When I was in the Marine Corps and I was studying these NATO documents on the geometries of modern biology, chemistry, and physics, what I did is I spent years connecting a particular pattern empirically rediscovered in biology, chemistry, or physics with the exact same pattern being taught in ancient China, India, Egypt, Greece, other cultures. And you can see the one-to-one connection between them. There's something I talk about in my Gaia series when I talk about it wasn't an accident that the form that the Greeks refused to teach publicly of the five Platonic solids, the dodecahedron, it wasn't an accident that was the one they didn't teach publicly, because they said it could lead to tremendous destruction if it was misused. That was 2,500 years ago. And then I show in the series that the first nuclear weapon was built in the form of a dodecahedron. Why? Because they couldn't create critical mass without putting it in a dodecahedral form. Once we use pattern recognition through being able to see the patterns that were being described for internal spiritual development and development of consciousness and energy in the ancient traditions, and we can then match them through pattern recognition to what's being discovered in the modern day with these same forms. That's what I think opens up this new holistic science. And so I'm so excited about the work that you're doing.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, I guess just a quick thing to comment on that is, I appreciate, yeah, the appreciation of, yeah, the importance of mapping these state spaces. And I mean, I think like the reason why, in some sense, we've been able to do very generative and useful work at Qualia Research Institute is because our paradigm for mapping actually focuses on what we call the phenomenal character of experience, essentially the structure of the experience. Because, I mean, there's definitely no shortages of people's, let's say, like ayahuasca trip reports. There's a lot of people who write them, but usually they will write them just in terms of a narrative, right? It's like, well, I went to this universe and I met an angel, I met a clown, I met a jester, and then this happened and they tricked me. With no mention of like, well, but what shapes? What was the frequency dynamics? What was the energy flow? Which is, in some sense, the thing that will give you more information about what was going on, where you were. Because narratives, you can have the same narrative with the completely different textures of experience. And I want to, yeah, kind of like mention that I think this approach also is essentially what allowed like people like Maxwell and Faraday to make big breakthroughs and realize that, like, actually, you know, electromagnetism, you know, back then, okay, like electricity and lightning and magnets, like, cannot be explained unless you have a field paradigm of physics. And essentially, you know, just a quick illustration. This is the classic, it's called a treatise on electromagnetism by Maxwell, you know, like published in the 1800s. And at the very end, you actually have like all of these like illustrations of like the different field lines that they were observing. And the thing is, like, you know, from their point of view is like, okay, this is things that we can see in the lab, right? Like we can actually see these structures in the lab. And other scientists were like ignoring that. It's like, well, sure, they know that you can do this in the lab, but they had like no theory for it. So they're just kind of ignoring all this information. But Maxwell and Faraday were like, wait, no, we need to develop new mathematics to model these fields. And then I also recommend very much this book afterwards, kind of like the actual equations of Maxwell and Faraday were like developed by the next generation of scientists, Fitzgerald, Lodge, and Heaviside. And essentially the whole insight was to realize, hey, this is not just particles and forces, it's the behavior of a field. And you need to describe the differential equations of that field. I think that hopefully we're about to experience the same paradigm shift in consciousness, that we stop seeing it as just kind of, yeah, these particles and forces. It's like, no, look at the fields, these, you know, DMT or sacred geometrical shapes, they're telling us very important information about the actual deep, deep mathematics of how all of this works. So, I mean, I think of it, it's, yeah, it's gonna definitely be a part of a, yeah, you know, integration of science, spirituality, essentially bringing to light all of these findings. So.
I so appreciate what you're doing there with the mathematics. And just a quick comment before we get back to the moderator, that my focus has been primarily on the geometric side of it, again, through pattern recognition and making connections there. And it always reminds me of the fact that it's said that in some ancient temples of initiation in Greece and elsewhere, that there would be a sign over the door saying, "Let no one ignorant of geometry enter here." Yeah. Because that becomes the language. Just like mathematics is a language, geometry is another side of that language. And if you can actually recognize the geometric forms and know what they do energetically and in consciousness, then when a person has a psychotropic experience, they can actually read the environment. They can actually read what's happening around them. But before, it was just a script they couldn't read. So I think this is also a part of what we're seeing today, where there's been this huge resurgence in psychotropic awareness and experimentation, partly because in places like Silicon Valley, so many people in Silicon Valley who are making our new technologies are constantly microdosing, and they talk about it very publicly because it's opening up these new levels of perception. This is beginning to really take on a mainstream level. And now with legalization of psilocybin and other substances for psychological work, it's amazing what's happening here. But I definitely think the work you're doing for mathematics is so important, and that people learn the geometry and can recognize the.
Are you back?
So I want to do something that's very simple, but very direct. It's one of the most important exercises that we can learn as far as energetic movements in the human energy field. And I've mentioned it in the Gaia series. I teach it in other spiritual science courses on my website. But this is the whole idea that we moved from the singularity, the zero-dimensional point, what in classical traditions we call the divine plane, that expanded outward in the cosmic expansion talked about in modern physics to become the sphere of manifest creation. And so our normal perception through our five senses, like Aldous Huxley talked about, our normal perception through the five senses is something moving from inside of us to outside of us. we're putting our attention from inside to outside to be able to pick up the information outside of us so that we don't get hit by a truck walking across the street, or we'll be able to navigate in a physical world. But for physical world experience, that outward movement of the senses is absolutely essential. But for experiencing the higher dimensions, like the higher worlds, the spiritual world, it's an exact opposite movement. Everything in the world is created on equal and opposite movements and energies. So if we want to experience the higher worlds, spiritual worlds, higher dimensions, whatever you want to call them, that requires the opposite movement of moving into the center, bringing our attention back from outside of us and moving it back into a concentrated center. So in classical traditions, they would teach this moving into the primary energy centers of the human body, our wormholes, which can be developed as latent organs of spiritual perception, as they would describe the chakras, or in the sense that it was being described a moment ago, potentially creating internal wormholes in the human being to access higher level information fields. And so they would move their energy and attention into the center of a center of a center at one of these energy centers. And in the modern world, we usually start with this at the point between the eyebrows. And I want to give credit for my being first exposed to this and taught the basic methods by a French medical doctor who was a brain specialist named Dr. Samuel Sagan, who created the Clairvision School, which used to be in Australia and is now in the US. And this is a classical method, but I think it's very, very important. And so because modern people are very head focused, there's a very important formula for all of this psychonaut work, which is energy follows attention. Wherever you put your attention, your energy is going to follow. And so they will have, and I'm going to ask you to, for this exercise, put your attention between the eyebrows, slightly inside the skull, and that's considered to be the frontal third eye center in the Himalayan tradition. But it is also connecting to the location of the cave of Brahma inside the head, which is the third ventricle of the brain, which has the pineal and pituitary glands on either sides of an opening in the brain through which the ocean of cerebral spinal fluid pulses inside of our heads. So if you put your attention between the eyebrows, that's about a half an inch or so inside of the skull, I'm going to invite you just to close your eyes for a moment and to put your attention at this point between the eyebrows, slightly inside the skull, and become aware of whatever you feel there. If you put your attention there inside the skull, don't think about it from the outside. You have to literally close your eyes and put your mind inside the point between the eyebrows. And if you get quiet for a moment and focus on it, what most people will start to feel at that location of that energy field is between the eyebrows, you might feel vibration or tingling or a feeling of density or sometimes a feeling of pressure. And these are indications to us of becoming aware of the different energy at this location in the energy body. When you become aware of any of these, vibration, tingling, density, pressure, at that point between the eyebrows, then move all of your energy and attention into the center of the center of the center of the center of that location at the third eye. It's a constant dynamic movement into the center of the center of the center. And once you start that movement, you can just sort of let go and be pulled into the center. It's like being pulled into the center of a vortex, being pulled into a type of a tunnel. Classic method here, absolutely universal method. And as you move into the center of the center of the center, you'll go, after you go into it enough, which may require more time than we have here, but just let you know the trajectory. As you go into it, what you become aware of at a certain point is rather than the feeling in the etheric life body of the density, pressure, tingling, vibration, you'll then start to get internal sensations, either perceived as visual imagery or felt as colors and things like that. But you'll become aware of having moved as you go constantly dynamically into the center of the center of the center of this third eye space. You'll become aware of light and color. The light and color may be small pinpoints of light and color. It may be streams of light and color. It could be clouds of light and color, or it could simply be the feeling of light and color based on how your energy body is developed at this point. And if you keep going into the center of the center of the center of the center of where you're now perceiving the light and color at this location between the eyebrows, then at a certain point, you'll come to another level, a higher level, which appears as a dark purple light. Some traditions call it the spiritual light. The Freemasons called it darkness visible, and that was very misinterpreted by many people. But it's a dark purple light, like a black light, that becomes a complete background of your perception. It's best done in a completely dark room. And then as you keep moving into the center of the center of the center of now, this expansive dark purple light space, you may start to become aware of vortex movements that are appearing in front of you. And in classical traditions, you would then put your attention into the vortex, into the wormhole, to be carried to the next place that you're going to experience as a psychonaut. Okay, we can go ahead and take a moment and open your eyes. So this method of constant dynamic movement into the center of the center of the center can be done at any energy center in our own body. And when developed to a higher level, you can even do it with permission in energy centers of other people's bodies, where you then become aware of content that they're holding within these centers at more advanced levels of this type of work. So that's using a geometric template, that movement of the singularity out to creation and our senses moving out to perceive, and now reversing it back to the singularity, back to the wormhole, back to the center of this hyperbolic geometry around the head. And again, this is a fundamental practice in many traditions, but rarely discussed anymore today. So thank you for giving me the time for that. Thank you for doing it with me. And again, there's more information about this with the spiritual science and vibrational science courses on my website, vesica.org. So let's go back to the moderators, see where we are now in time.
Thank you, Robert, for the meditation. Personally, I felt pressure and tingly both at the same time. Felipe has asked, Andreas, is it possible that we can undo the pinch point that separates us from the one consciousness and come back with information, or the typology prohibits us from doing it? Andreas, if you could answer that question.
it's hard to tell, but usually, let's say if you have a breakthrough level 5-MeO DMT experience, which tends to be kind of like union with the universal field, like that's the phenomenology of it, it's very, very difficult to bring back any information. It's almost kind of like the smoothness of the geometry of the space itself is in some sense a manifestation of zero information. If you're interested in this concept, I have a video called Why Does Anything Exist? And I think like in the end, kind of like pure consciousness is in some sense indistinguishable from zero information, which in a also very strange sense is indistinguishable from all things happening simultaneously. And in that sense, like the creation of information is actually happens through like ruling out possibilities. So like when you are actually kind of the superposition of everything simultaneously, there's really nothing to bring back. It's very, very strange. Now, you know, kind of like taking anecdotal data seriously, undoing the pinch point could happen not only in terms of like getting unified with the field, universal field around you, kind of the, you know, apersonal a field, but also potentially if you focus it with somebody and you undo the pinch point, so rather than undoing the pinch point with the rest of reality, if you actually undo the pinch point with somebody, then that at least is reported as, you know, some packets of information, as maybe Robert was saying, like things that each of them has been kind of like holding very deep inside, that may be transmitted with a very, very high bandwidth. And at least from like, you know, self reports, people have sent me pretty stunning trip reports. That is sort of what's associated with remote viewing, successful remote viewing. There's some sense in which you need to become one with the other to do it effectively, rather than just, you know, kind of in a spy way, it just doesn't work that way. You need the actual unity, to actually share the information.
I'd like to throw one thing in there too. That was a great answer, Andre. And I'd like to address it from the perspective of classical spiritual traditions. And that is that they understand that as we go into deeper and deeper levels of less and less physical-like higher worlds, that at a certain point, based on the level to which a person has structured their subtle bodies, literally structured their subtle bodies in geometric ways, based on the level of development of the subtle bodies that people have done, they will begin to go unconscious at certain levels. These are the levels that were described as a ring pass knot in ancient spiritual traditions. You hit the ring pass knot, you can't get past it because you go unconscious after them. But what they found is that, and this is like in very deep ashram environments in India and all types of things, that years and years of internal practice to structure the subtle body and to lead our energy through our attention to structuring these higher levels of consciousness, a person can get through those rings pass knot and can start to remain conscious at levels at which they would normally go unconscious. I would actually see in many of my courses when I would do them live before, as we went into very deep levels of spiritual meditation or dealt with some very, very deep spiritual topics, at certain points, some people in the room would literally go like this, like they lost consciousness, like a boom, they'd like go down. And I began to be a little bit concerned about it, but I saw it happen enough that I realized what was happening. And people would say, oh, at that point, I just go out, that they're not able to hold that level of charge, not able to hold that structure yet. But through certain types of internal structuring practices, you are able to hold it and keep expanding it further. So I do think, for example, some people in Silicon Valley who are doing the microdosing and things, they're accessing some other realms and bringing back some information. And I do believe that it's something that's based on the level of our own internal development and the structuring of the subtle bodies. One other just very quick thing, because I'm almost out of time, but somebody asked a question about how do you develop discernment? And I didn't read the end of the question, but a very quick answer to that from my perspective, develop discernment about what you're experiencing in these higher worlds. It'll be a long answer, but the shortest part of the answer is through non-attachment. Don't get attached to anything that you see, that you feel, anything that's happening. You simply observe and don't try to grasp it. The moment you try to grasp it, the Tibetans talk about this all the time in higher experience. Don't try to grasp the experience. If you do, you'll corrupt it or it'll disappear. You have to have a different internal movement of almost sitting back and observing, and then you let it expand in front of you to reveal itself. There's more to the answer, but that's like what I would say would be the first part of the how do we develop discernment?
Thank you, Robert. The next question is from Dominicus. He's asking, I wonder about healing with frequencies. Are we far enough to know frequencies and modes of appliance for healing people? It sounds like it might be a very easily doable once the knowledge is there. What do you think, Robert?
Oh, absolutely. So I would recommend to people take a look at the books coming from microcurrent research currently. And so there's a woman named Carolyn McMakin, and Carolyn McMakin wrote a book called The Resonance Effect that describes her work in microcurrent therapy and the incredible results they've had by knowing the exact biological result of specific frequencies. That book, The Resonance Effect by Carolyn McMakin, shows you how far this field has come that most people have never heard about, and it's written for the public. Then she has another book that's on specific use of microcurrent for pain relief. And I'm working right now for some things I'm going to be adding to my website within the next month in the part of my website that has the 12 topics for Vesica for 2023. I'm going to be adding more specific information about resources that people can access for microcurrent therapy in the home. But essentially, it's already far more developed than people think. We know a lot of the frequencies. And the other thing to look at is cymatherapy. They know how to combine specific sound waves together to create composite sound codes to create the restoration of the original resonance of the organs and glands in the body. It's absolutely incredible stuff. So microcurrent and cymatherapy.
I want to add here. No, that's a wonderful answer. From the point of view of a QRI, we have a video about it's called. I mean, it's like the latest video on the QRI YouTube channel, which essentially says exploring haptic vibration, exploratory research with haptic vibration, which is like body vibration. And what's really, I think, like noteworthy here is that we went into that research without any preconceptions. We just kind of like went and explored and systematically mapped the space. And essentially, we developed something like a music theory for body vibrations. And, you know, it turns out like, yeah, we, I guess, like rediscovered that actually there's like a whole math of harmony for body vibrations. And like the healing is not so much the frequencies, it's more like the way in which they are related to each other. The healing timbres, they're all harmonic, resonant and reverb. And it's essentially actually sounds kind of like new age music, but in the body vibration. And that's like the most healing that we found. So I don't know, it's not worthy that like, you know, like we kind of rediscovered a lot of things intuitive practitioners have known for a while.
We have time for one more question. Don Abel has asked, do you think that people who have contact with extraterrestrial beings in the physical or in their dreams are experiencing these higher levels of consciousness? I think that's to both of you, Robert and Andreas.
Andreas, you want to go first?
Yes, for sure, for sure. I mean, what I can say there is that the states of consciousness disclosed during dreaming tend to have what we call like a more resonant neuroacoustics. So essentially, you know, there's people with anhedonia, for example, they don't experience like pleasure on everyday life. Maybe, for example, after like taking like SSRIs for many years, in some people, not everybody, but in some people, like that blunts their affect. But then they report, like in dreams, all of a sudden, all of their emotions are back, right? And, you know, from personal, you know, like lucid dreaming exploration. And also I get sleep paralysis sometimes often, especially when I was like younger. The body is way more resonant in those states. And essentially you can activate very, very intense emotions for that reason and trap a lot of energy. I mean, I think like the jhanas are actually, you know, these very highly concentrated states of consciousness, much more accessible during sleep paralysis and dreaming. And talking to people who are very advanced meditators, they all essentially agree that like there's a lot of like very advanced, very energetic states of consciousness that become way easier to access in like lucid dreaming. So actually like meditating during lucid dreaming may actually have like kind of like extra accessibility. You may do like things in meditation that are not possible when you're awake, at least without like further practice.
So for myself, I'm going to blow any final credibility I have with the materialistic scientific community by answering the question this way, which is that we live in a universe of multiple dimensions, and the physical world is one part of it. But the physical world itself is a gigantic universe. And no doubt there are other conscious beings that take physical form somewhere in our universe. And no doubt at some point, connection or communication takes place with that. Now, what I want to bring out, though, is that in classical traditions, a lot of what is said in classical traditions about non-physical intelligences is being interpreted today through the lens of extraterrestrials and ETs. And so lots of times people, even if they don't connect with anything physically, they don't need a physical being, but on an inner plane, an inner way, you connect with another being. Lots of times, because of the way that we are presented images and things in our society, we will see that as an extraterrestrial. In a sense, like, yeah, I guess they're extraterrestrial. But we have to see the degree to which now a lot of direct experience of higher intelligences, which may not exist on the physical plane at all, is being interpreted through an ET lens, which is fine, but we got to make sure that we don't lose the baby with the bathwater, that there is a range of intelligences of all types of level, the vast majority of which are never physicalized, but nonetheless very real, in some ways more real than we are, and at a higher level of consciousness. Now, a lot of what happens in academic work is when we have these experiences in psychotropics, the way to maintain credibility in academic circles is to say, oh, well, that's actually just our own internal experience that we're projecting outward and seeing it as an external being. And in many cases, that's no doubt the case. Particularly at the beginning stages, a lot of what we're encountering outside of us is coming out of us. But there's a reversal process talked about in the ancient traditions where stuff we're sending out at the first stages of psychotropics looks like it's approaching us. It's an inverted thing. So it's actually true that a lot of what we perceive at the first stages of psychotropic experience are things that we're sending out and interpreting as something external. But at the higher levels, I do believe that we actually connect with these higher intelligences. If they take on physical, concrete existence the way that we do, we can think of them as extraterrestrials. But we have to be aware there's a huge world out there of intelligences and beings in their own structures that we can connect with that simply don't take on physical incarnation. And that's where the work with psychotropics becomes something that expands our mind and our consciousness, the way they talked about in the ancient Egyptian tradition. That's very important, because they talked about we have to prepare ourselves for the journey past the gate of death. And they kept preparing their initiates for the journey past the gate of death. Memento mori, we're all going to die. And it's probably going to be sooner than any of us think. And so if we prepare ourselves through these experiences, their idea was that by doing psychotropics and by doing spiritual practices, sometimes together, they would structure their subtle bodies. And then when they pass through the gate of death, they actually have organs of spiritual perception to perceive what's happening to them, rather than just being in a tripping type of experience out of the body after death, where you can't make sense of anything. So we're out of time, so I'll leave it at that. Thank you.